every man, perhaps every woman and child, lies face downward on the battlefield. Thousands of Japanese, maybe hundreds of thousands, accept it literally. To ignore this suicide complex would be as dangerous as our pre-war oversight of Japanese determination and cunning, which made Pearl Harbor possible. American fighting men, back from the front, have been trying to tell America this is a war of extermination. They have seen it from foxholes and barren strips of bullet-strafed sand. I have seen it from behind enemy lines. Our picture coincides. This is a war of extermination. The Japanese militarists have made it that way. The fighting men of the Navy and the Air Force had seen particular evidence of Japanese doggedness that autumn and winter in the appearance of kamikazes, planes loaded with high explosives and deliberately flown to ram ships. Between October and March, young Japanese pilots, most of them barely qualified university students, sacrificed themselves in some 900 sorties. Navy fighters and anti-aircraft guns shot most of the kamikazes down. About 400 U.S. ships were hit, and only about 100 sunk or severely damaged in a fleet of thousands. But the attacks were alien and terrifying. They served to confirm for Americans the extent of Japanese desperation, even as they further depleted Japan's waning air defenses. LeMay's Pathfinders arrived first over Tokyo a little after midnight on March 10th. On the district of Shitamachi, on the flatlands east of the Sumida River, where 750,000 people lived crowded into wood and paper houses, they marked a diagonal of fire and then crossed it to ignite a gigantic, glowing X. At 0100, the main force of B-29s came on and began methodically bombing the flatlands. The wind was blowing at 15 miles per hour. The bombers carried their 1,520 M-69s in 500-pound clusters that broke apart a few hundred feet above the ground. Main force intervalometers, the bomb bay mechanisms that spaced the release of the clusters, had been set for 50-foot intervals. Each plane load then covered about a third of a square mile of houses. If only a fifth of the incendiaries started fires, that was one fire for every 30,000 square feet. One fire for every 15 or 20 closely spaced houses. Robert Guillen remembers a deadlier density. The inhabitants stayed heroically put as the bombs dropped, faithfully obeying the order that each family defend its own house. But how could they fight the fires with that wind blowing, and when a single house might be hit by 10 or even more of the bombs that were raining down by the thousands? As they fell, cylinders scattered a kind of flaming dew that skittered along the roofs, setting fire to everything it splashed and spreading a wash of dancing flames everywhere. By 0200, the wind had increased to more than 20 miles per hour. Guillen climbed to his roof to observe. The fire, whipped by the wind, began to sigh its way through the density of that wooden city. A huge borealis grew. The bright light dispelled the night, and B-29s were visible here and there in the sky. For the first time, they flew low or middling high in staggered levels. Their long, glinting wings, sharp as blades, could be seen through the oblique columns of smoke rising from the city, suddenly reflecting the fire from the furnace below, black silhouettes gliding through the fiery sky to reappear farther on, shining golden against the dark roof of heaven, or glittering blue like meteors in the searchlight beams spraying the vault from horizon to horizon. All the Japanese in the gardens near mine were out of doors or peering up out of their holes, uttering cries of admiration. This was typically Japanese at this grandiose, almost theatrical spectacle. Something worse than a firestorm was kindled in Tokyo that night. The U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey calls it a conflagration, begun when the high wind heeled over the pillar of hot and burning gases that the fires had volatilized and convection had carried up into the air. The chief characteristic of the conflagration was the presence of a fire front, an extended wall of fire moving to leeward, preceded by a mass of preheated, turbid burning vapors. The pillar was in a much more turbulent state than that of a firestorm, and being usually closer to the ground, it produced more flame and heat and less smoke. The progress and destructive features of the conflagration were consequently much greater than those of a firestorm, for the fire continued to spread until it could reach no more material. The 28-mile-per-hour wind, measured a mile from the fire, increased to an estimated 55 miles at the perimeter, and probably more within. An extended fire swept over 15 square miles in 6 hours. Pilots reported that the air was so violent that B-29s at 6,000 feet were turned completely over, and that the heat was so intense, even at that altitude, that the entire crew had to don oxygen masks. The area of the fire was nearly 100% burned. No structure or its contents escaped damage. The fire had spread largely in the direction of the natural wind. A bombardier who flew through the black turbulence above the conflagration remembers it as the most terrifying thing I've ever known. In the shallower canals of Shitamachi, where people submerged themselves to escape the fire, the water boiled. The Sumida River stopped the conflagration from sweeping more than 15.8 square miles of the city. The Strategic Bombing Survey estimates that probably more persons lost their lives by fire at Tokyo in a 6-hour period than at any equivalent period of time in the history of man. The firestorm at Dresden may have killed more people, but not in so short a space of time. More than 100,000 men, women, and children died in Tokyo on the night of March 9 through 10, 1945. 1 million were injured, at least 41,000 seriously. 1 million in all lost their homes. 2,000 tons of incendiaries delivered that punishment. In the modern notation, 2 kilotons. But the wind, not the weight of bombs alone, created the conflagration, and therefore the efficiency of the slaughter was in some sense, still in part, an act of God. Hap Arnold sent LeMay a triumphant telex. "Congratulations, this mission shows your crews have got the guts for anything." Certainly LeMay did. Having gambled and succeeded, he quickly pushed on. His B-29s firebombed Nagoya on March 11th. Firebombed Osaka by radar on March 13th, firebombed Kobe on March 16th. Stocks of M-69s were running low, and M-17A1 clusters of 4-pound magnesium thermite bombs, less effective, had to be substituted. Firebombed Nagoya again on March 18th. "Then," says LeMay, "we ran out of bombs. Literally. In 10 days and 1,600 sorties, the 20th Air Force burned out 32 square miles of the centers of Japan's 4 largest cities and killed at least 150,000 people and almost certainly tens of thousands more." "I consider that, for the first time," LeMay wrote Norstad privately in April, "strategic air bombardment faces a situation in which its strength is proportionate to the magnitude of its task. I feel that the destruction of Japan's ability to wage war lies within the capability of this command." He had found a method, LeMay had begun to believe, whereby the Air Force might end the Pacific War without invasion. At Oak Ridge, guests removed their shoes before entering a house. Hiring was still increasing on the muddy Tennessee reservation, and construction continuing. Challenges to the meager ground cover that a Tennessee Eastman employee was moved to immortalize anonymously in verse. "In order not to check in late, I've had to lose a lot of weight from swimming through a fair-sized flood and wading through the goddamn mud. I've lost my rubbers and my shoes. Perpetually I have the blues. My spirits tumble with a thud because of all this goddamn mud." It's in my system so that when I cut my finger now and then, instead of bleeding just plain blood, out pours a stream of goddamn mud. Mud measured progress. Ernest Lawrence's calutrons, built at such great expense, had begun enriching uranium. A minimum of 100 grams per day, 3.5 ounces, of 10% U-235 came through the Alpha racetracks beginning in late September 1944. But poor planning for chemical recovery of that feed from the Beta tanks wasted some 40% of it, as Mark Oliphant reported to James Chadwick from Oak Ridge early in November. This loss, or holdup, has resulted in a very serious delay in the production of material for the first weapon. The chemistry, viewed as a whole, I believe to present an appalling example of lack of coordination, of inefficiency, and bad management. A copy of Oliphant's complaint went to Groves, who must have acted quickly. The troubleshooting Australian physicist could report to the general 2 weeks later that the output from the Beta tracks has shown an abrupt and very satisfying upward trend. In his letter to Chadwick, Oliphant had noted a Beta output of only 40 grams per day. Now, an output of about 90 grams per day has been reached, and there is reason for believing that this level would be maintained, or even increased, during the coming months. He concluded optimistically that there is now a definite hope that continued effort on the part of the operating company and others will lead early in the new year to a plant output of the order of that expected. As of January 1945, on any given day, about 85% of some 864 Alpha Calutron tanks operated to produce 258 grams, 9 ounces, of 10% enriched product. At the same time, 36 Beta tanks converted the accumulated Alpha product to 204 grams, 7.2 ounces per day, of 80% enriched U-235. Sufficient enrichment to make a bomb. James Brian Conant calculated in his handwritten history notes on January 6th that a kilogram of U-235 per day would mean one gun bomb every 6 weeks. It follows that the gun bomb required about 42 kilograms, 92.6 pounds, about 2.8 critical masses of U-235. Without further improvement, the calutrons alone could produce that much material in 6.8 months, and Conant noted, after conferring with Groves, that it looks as if 40 to 45 kilograms will be obtained by July 1st. Ernest Lawrence's monumental effort had succeeded. Every gram of U-235 in the one little boy that should be ready by mid-1945 would pass at least once through his calutrons. Conant also contrasted his assumptions of June 1944 with his assumptions at the beginning of the new year to draw up a problematic balance sheet. While he had previously believed a few bombs might do the trick of ending the war, at the beginning of 1945 he was convinced many bombs will now be required. German experience. The German experience was probably the determined German resistance that was prolonging the war in Europe, particularly the counter-offensive through the Ardennes, known as the Battle of the Bulge, that had begun in mid-December and still threatened Allied lines at the time of Conant's notes. It was partly Allied frustration with such continuing resistance that would lead, in another month, to the atrocity of the Dresden bombing. Huday Hershey was finally delivering satisfactory barrier tubes for the K-25 gaseous diffusion plant. Union Carbide had scheduled barrier delivery to take advantage of K-25's organization as a cascade. As individual tanks, called converters, arrived, workers hooked them into the system and tested them for leaks in atmospheres of nitrogen and helium with the portable mass spectrometers that Alfred Nyer had designed. When a stage was leak-proof and otherwise ready, it could be operated without further delay, and the first stage of the enormous K-25 cascade was charged with uranium hexafluoride on January 20, 1945. Enrichment by gaseous barrier diffusion in the most advanced automated industrial plant in the world had begun. It would proceed efficiently with only normal maintenance for decades. The pipes in Philip Abelson's scaled-up thermal diffusion plant, S-50, leaked so badly they had to be welded, which delayed production. But all 21 racks had begun enriching uranium by March. Juggling the different enrichment processes to produce maximum output in minimum time then became a complex mathematical and organizational challenge. Lieutenant Colonel Kenneth Dean Nichols, Groves's talented and long-suffering assistant, worked out the scheduling. Based on Nichols' schedule, Groves decided in mid-March not to build more alpha calutrons, as Lawrence had proposed, but to construct instead a second gaseous diffusion plant and a fourth beta plant. Though he certainly expected his atomic bombs to end the war, Groves seems to have justified the new construction by the Joint Chiefs' conservative estimate that the Pacific War would end 18 months after the European. His new plants could not be completed before February 15, 1946, he explained in his proposal. But on the assumption that the war with Japan will not be over before July 1946, it is planned to proceed with the additions to the two plants unless instructions to the contrary are received. Perhaps he was simply being prudent. Early in 1945, Oak Ridge began shipping bomb-grade U-235 to Los Alamos. Between shipments, Groves took no chances with a substance far more valuable gram for gram than diamonds. Although the Army had condemned all the land and ejected the original inhabitants from the Clinton Reservation area, at the dead end of a dusty reservation back road, cattle grazed in a pasture beside a white farmhouse. A concrete silo towered over the road, which was sheltered by a steep bluff. From the air, the scene resembled any number of small Tennessee holdings. But the silo was a machine gun emplacement. The farm was manned by security guards, and built into the side of the bluff, a concrete bunker shielded a bank-sized vault, completely encircled with guarded walkways. In this pastoral fortress, Groves stored his accumulating grams of U-235. Armed couriers transported it as uranium tetrafluoride in special luggage by car to Knoxville, where they boarded the overnight express to Chicago. They passed on the luggage the next morning to their Chicago counterparts, who held reserve space on the Santa Fe Chief. 26 hours later, in mid-afternoon, the Chicago couriers debarked at Lamy, the stranded desert way station that served Santa Fe. Los Alamos security men met the train and completed the transfer to the hill, where chemists waited eagerly to reduce the rare cargo to metal. Plutonium production at Hanford depended as much on chemical separation as it did on chain-reacting piles. The chemistry was Glenn Seaborg's, spectacularly scaled up a billionfold directly from his team's earlier ultra-microchemical work. The plutonium in the slugs irradiated in the Hanford piles emerged mixed to the extent of only about 250 parts per million with uranium and highly radioactive fission products. Carrier chemistry, the fractional crystallization of Marie Curie and Otto Hahn, was therefore required to help the scant plutonium along. The man-made metal is extremely poisonous if ingested, but only mildly radioactive. To make it safe to handle, it also needed to be purified to less than 1 part in 10 million of fission products. And because the pile slugs developed such a burden of radioactivity, all but the final chemical processing had to be carried out by remote control behind thick shielding. Seaborg's team developed two separation processes to take advantage of the different chemistries of plutonium's several different valence states. One process used bismuth phosphate as a carrier. The other used lanthanum fluoride. Bismuth phosphate, scaled up directly from MetLab experiments, served the primary purpose of uranium and fission product decontamination. Lanthanum fluoride, applied at pilot scale at Oak Ridge, then concentrated the plutonium from the large volume of solution in which it was suspended. Hanford was the largest plant DuPont had ever constructed and operated, not least among its facilities were the chemical separation buildings. Originally, 8 separation plants were considered necessary, writes Groves, then 6, then 4. Finally, with the benefit of the operating experience and information obtained from the Clinton semi-works, We decided to build only three, of which two would operate and one would serve as a reserve. For safety, the plants went up behind Gable Mountain, 10 miles southwest of the Riverside Piles. Each building was 800 feet long, 65 feet wide, and 80 feet tall. Hoard concrete structures so massive, the workers called them Queen Marys. The British ocean liner of that name was only a fifth again as long. The Queen Marys were essentially large concrete boxes, says Groves, containment buildings, in which there were individual cells containing the various parts involved in the process equipment. To provide protection from the intense radioactivity, the cells were surrounded by concrete walls 7 feet thick and were covered by 6 feet of concrete. Each Queen Mary contained 40 cells, and each cell's lid, which could be removed by an overhead crane that rolled the length of the building's long canyon, weighed 35 tons. Irradiated slugs ejected from a production pile would be stored in pools of water 16.5 feet deep to remain until the most intense and therefore short-lived of their fission product radioactivities decayed away, the water glowing blue around them with Cernikov radiation, a sort of charged particle sonic boom. The slugs would then move in shielded casks on special railroad cars to one of the Queen Marys, where they would first be dissolved in hot nitric acid. A standard equipment group occupied two cells, a centrifuge, a catch tank, a precipitator, and a solution tank, all made of specially fabricated corrosion-resistant stainless steel. The liquid solution that the slugs had become would move through these units by steam jet siphoning, a low-maintenance substitute for pumps. There were three necessary steps to the separation process: solution, precipitation, and centrifugal removal of the precipitate. These would repeat from equipment group to equipment group down the canyon of the separation building. The end products would be radioactive wastes stored on site in underground tanks and small quantities of highly purified plutonium nitrate. Once the Queen Marys were contaminated with radioactivity, no repair crews could enter them. Equipment operators had to be able to maintain them entirely by remote control. The operators trained at DuPont in Delaware, at Oak Ridge, and on mock-ups at Hanford. But the engineer in charge, Raymond Genereau, sought more authoritative qualification and found it. He required his operators, 100 of whom arrived in Hanford in October 1944, to install the process equipment into the first completed separation building by remote control, pretending the canyon was already radioactive. They did, awkwardly at first, but with increasing confidence as practice improved their remote manipulation skills. When the Queen Marys began to function, Leona Marshall remembers, dissolving the irradiated slugs in concentrated nitric acid, great plumes of brown fumes blossomed above the concrete canyons, climbed thousands of feet into the air, and drifted sideways as they cooled, blown by winds aloft. B-pile slugs traveled by rail into the 221T separation plant beginning on December 26, 1944. The yields in the first plant runs ranged between 60% and 70%, Seaborg notes proudly, and reached 90% in early February 1945. Lieutenant Colonel Franklin T. Mathias, Groves' representative at Hanford, personally carried the first small batch of plutonium nitrate by train from Portland to Los Angeles, where he turned it over to a Los Alamos security courier. Thereafter, shipments, small subcritical batches in metal containers in wooden boxes, traveled in convoy by Army ambulance via Boise, Salt Lake City, Grand Junction, and Pueblo to Los Alamos. Bertrand Goldschmidt, the French chemist who worked with Glenn Seaborg, puts the Manhattan Engineer District at the height of its wartime development in perspective with a startling comparison. It was, he writes in a memoir, the astonishing American creation in 3 years, at a cost of $2 billion, of a formidable array of factories and laboratories, as large as the entire automobile industry of the United States at that date. One of the mysteries of the Second World War was the lack of an early and dedicated American intelligence effort to discover the extent of German progress toward atomic bomb development. If, as the record repeatedly emphasizes, the United States was seriously worried that Germany might reverse the course of the war with such a surprise secret weapon, why did its intelligence organizations, or the Manhattan Project, not mount a major effort of espionage? Vannevar Bush had raised the question of espionage with Franklin Roosevelt at their crucial meeting on October 9, 1941, when Bush apprised the president of the Maud Report. But the OSRD director got no satisfactory answer, probably because the United States was not yet a belligerent. Groves, in his memoirs, passes the buck to the existing intelligence agencies, Army G2, the Office of Naval Intelligence, and the Office of Strategic Services, the forerunner of the CIA, and attributes the inadequacy of their information to the unfortunate relationships that had grown up among them. Why he failed to confront the issue himself until late 1943, when George Marshall asked him directly to do so, he chose not to say. One reason was certainly security, a Groves obsession. In order to know what to look for, intelligence agents would have to be briefed on at least isotope separation technologies and nuclear fission research, which would mean that any agent captured or turned might well give American secrets away. When Groves finally did take responsibility for intelligence gathering, he picked scientific personnel who had not worked within the Manhattan Project and authorized paramilitary operations to advance only into areas already occupied. That, at least, is how he intended his intelligence unit to operate. In practice, it frequently claimed its prizes in the no man's land between fighting fronts, by hook or by crook. The unit Groves authorized in late 1943 somehow acquired the name Alsos, Greek for Grove, and thus obscurely revealing. The brigadier thought to have it renamed, but I decided that to change it would only draw attention to it. To head the Alsos mission, he chose Lieutenant Colonel Boris T. Posh, a former high school teacher turned Army G2 security officer, FBI trained, who had made himself notorious in domestic intelligence circles for his flamboyant investigation of communist activities among the members of the staff of Ernest Lawrence's Berkeley Laboratory. Pash, trim and Slavic, with rimless glasses and light, thin hair, spoke Russian fluently and was a great hunter of communists. His background helps explain why. His Russian emigre father was the metropolitan, senior bishop of the Eastern Orthodox Church in North America. It was Pash who had interrogated Robert Oppenheimer about his communist affiliations while a clandestine recording device in the next room preserved the physicist's damaging evasions on blank sound motion picture film. He concluded, without hard evidence, that Oppenheimer was a Communist Party member gone underground and possibly a spy. Whatever Groves thought of Pasha's red-baiting, he chose him to head Alsos because he delivered the goods. His thorough competence and great drive had made a lasting impression on me. Pash set up a base in London in 1944 as the Allied armies pushed through France after the Normandy invasion. He then crossed the Channel with a squad of Alsos enlisted men and wheeled toward Paris by jeep. The Alsos advance party joined the 102nd U.S. Cavalry Group on Highway 188 at Orsay, a contemporary military intelligence report notes. The American force stopped outside Paris. Charles de Gaulle had persuaded Franklin Roosevelt to allow the Free French to enter the city first. But Pash decided to improvise. Colonel Pash and party then proceeded to cut across country to Highway 20 and joined second elements of a French armored division. The Alsos mission then entered the city of Paris, 0855 hours, 25 August 1944. The party proceeded to within the city in the rear of the first five French vehicles to enter, being the first American unit to enter Paris. The five French vehicles were tanks. In his unarmored jeep, Pash drew repeated sniper fire. He dodged among the back streets of Paris and, by the end of the day, had achieved his goal, the Radium Institute on the Rue Pierre Curie, There, he settled in for the evening to drink celebratory champagne with Frédéric Joliot. Joliot knew less about German uranium research than anyone had expected. Pasch moved his base to liberated Paris and began following up promising leads. One of the most significant pointed to Strasbourg, the old city on the Rhine in Alsace-Lorraine, which Allied forces began occupying in mid-November. Pasch found a German physics laboratory installed there in a building on the grounds of Strasbourg Hospital. His scientific counterpart on the Alsace team was Samuel A. Goudsmit, a Dutch theoretical physicist and Paul Ehrenfest protégé who had studied criminology and had previously worked at the MIT Radiation Laboratory. Goudsmit followed Pasch to Strasbourg, began laboriously examining documents, and hit the jackpot. He recalls the experience in a post-war memoir. "It is true that no precise information was given in these documents, but there was far more than enough to get a view of the whole German uranium project. We studied the papers by candlelight for 2 days and nights until our eyes began to hurt. The conclusions were unmistakable. The evidence at hand proved definitely that Germany had no atom bomb and was not likely to have one in any reasonable form." But paper evidence was not good enough for Groves. As far as he was concerned, he could close the books on the German program only when he had accounted for all the Union Minière uranium ore the Germans had confiscated when they invaded Belgium in 1940, some 1,200 tons in all, the only source of untraced bomb material available to them during the war, with the mines at Joachimstal under surveillance and the Belgian Congo cut off. Pasch had already liberated part of that supply, some 31 tons, from a French arsenal in Toulouse, where it had been diverted and secretly stored. Moving into Germany with the Allied armies after they crossed the Rhine late in March, he acquired a larger force of men, 2 armored cars mounted with 50-caliber machine guns, and 4 machine-gun-mounted jeeps, and began tracking the German atomic scientists themselves. "Washington wanted absolute proof," Pasch remembers, "that no atomic activity of which it did not know was being carried on by the Nazis. It also wanted to be sure that no prominent German scientist would evade capture or fall into the hands of the Soviet Union." Alsace moved through Heidelberg and picked up Walter Botha, whose laboratory contained Germany's only functioning cyclotron. Documents there pointed to Staudthiem, near Weimar, as the location of Kurt Diebner's laboratory. The small town proved to have become the central office of the German atomic research program as well, and although Werner Heisenberg and his group from the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes had moved to southern Germany to escape Allied bombing and the advancing Russian and Allied armies, there was a small amount of uranium oxide at Staudthiem to reward Pasch's search. Pasch missed the ore rescue. Groves's liaison man with the British had been watching a factory at Stassfurt near Magdeburg in northern Germany since late 1944, when documents captured in Brussels indicated it might house the balance of the Belgium ore. By early April 1945, the Red Army had advanced too close to that prize to leave it uninspected any longer. Groves arranged to assemble a mixed British and American strike force led by Lieutenant Colonel John Lansdale Jr., the security officer who had cleared Paul Tibbets to move in. The team met with the 12th Army Group's G2 in Göttingen to seek approval for the Stassfurt mission. Lansdale describes the confrontation in a report. "We outlined to him our proposal and advised him that if we found the material we were after, we proposed to remove it and that it would be necessary that we act with the utmost secrecy and greatest dispatch, inasmuch as a meeting between the Russian armies and Allied armies apparently would soon take place, and the area in which the material appeared to be was a part of the proposed Russian zone of occupation. The G2 was very perturbed at our proposal and foresaw all kinds of difficulties with the Russians and political repercussions at home. Said he must see the commanding general." That was calm, no-nonsense Omar Bradley. He went alone in to see General Bradley, who at that time was in conference with the 9th Army commander, within whose area Stassfurt then was. Both of them gave unqualified approval to our project, General Bradley being reported to have remarked, To hell with the Russians. On April 17th, led by an infantry division intelligence officer familiar with the area, Lansdale and his team struck for Stassfurt. The plant was a mess, both from our bombings and from looting by the French workmen. After going through mountains of paper, we located the lager, or inventory of papers, which disclosed the presence of the material we sought at the plant. This ore was fortunately stored above ground. It was in barrels in open-sided sheds and had obviously been there a long time, many of the barrels being broken open. Approximately 1,100 tons of ore were stored there. This was in various forms, mostly the concentrates from Belgium and about 8 tons of uranium oxide. Lansdale instructed his group to take inventory and went off to 9th Army headquarters. That organization assigned him 2 truck companies. He moved on to the nearest railhead within the permanent American zone of occupation, but found the commanding officer there too busy evacuating some 10,000 Allied prisoners of war to be able to offer more help than half a dozen men for guard duty. Lansdale improvised, locating empty airport hangars nearby where the ore could be stored awaiting shipment out of Germany, and arranged to have them cleared of booby traps. Then he returned to Stassfurt. Many of the barrels in which the material was packed were broken open, and the majority of those not broken open were in such a weakened condition that they could not stand transportation. A British and an American officer and I took a jeep and, scouting around the country, found in one small town a paper bag factory, which had a large supply of very heavy bags. We later sent a truck and obtained 10,000 of these. We also discovered in a mill a quantity of wire and the necessary implements for closing the bags. By the evening of 19th April, we had a large crew busily engaged in repacking the material, and that night the movement of the material to the railhead started. Boris Pasch, in the meantime, continued to chase down the German atomic scientists. Alsace documents placed Werner Heisenberg, Otto Hahn, Carl von Weizsäcker, Max von Laue, and the others in their organization in the Black Forest region of southwest Germany, in the resort town of Hagerlach. By late April, the German front had broken, and the French were moving ahead. Pasch and his forces, which now included a battalion of combat engineers, got word in the middle of the night and raced around Stuttgart in their jeeps and trucks and armored cars to beat the French to Hagerlach. They drew German fire along the way and returned it. In the meantime, Lansdale, in London, reassembled his British-American team and flew over to follow Pasch in. The story is properly Pasch's. Hagerlach is a small, picturesque town straddling the Eyach River. As we approached it, pillowcases, sheets, towels, and other white articles attached to flagpoles, broomsticks, and window shutters flew the message of surrender. While our engineer friends were busy consolidating the first Alsace-directed seizure of an enemy town, Pasch's men led teams in a rapid operation to locate Nazi research facilities. They soon found an ingenious setup that gave almost complete protection from aerial observation and bombardment, a church atop a cliff. Hurrying to the scene, I saw a box-like concrete entrance to a cave in the side of an 80-foot cliff towering above the lower level of the town. The heavy steel door was padlocked. A paper stuck on the door indicated the manager's identity. When the manager was brought to me, he tried to convince me that he was only an accountant. When he hesitated at my command to unlock the door, I said, "Bateson, shoot the lock off. If he gets in the way, shoot him." The manager opened the door. In the main chamber was a concrete pit about 10 feet in diameter. Within the pit hung a heavy metal shield covering the top of a thick metal cylinder. The latter contained a pot-shaped vessel, also of heavy metal, about 4 feet below the floor level. Atop the vessel was a metal frame. A German prisoner confirmed the fact that we had captured the Nazi uranium machine, as the Germans called it. Actually, an atomic pile. Pasch left Goldsmith and his several colleagues behind at Hagerlach on April 23rd and rushed to nearby Heckingen. There he found the German scientists, all except Otto Hahn, whom he picked up in Tallefingen 2 days later, and Werner Heisenberg, whom he located with his family at a lake cottage in Bavaria. The pile at Hagerlach had served for the KWI's final round of neutron multiplication studies. 1.5 tons of carefully husbanded Norsk Hydro heavy water moderated it. Its fuel consisted of 664 cubes of metallic uranium attached to 78 chains that hung down into the water from the metal shield, Posh describes. With this elegant arrangement and a central neutron source, the KWI team in March had achieved nearly sevenfold neutron multiplication. Heisenberg had calculated at the time that a 50% increase in the size of the reactor would produce a sustained chain reaction. The fact that the German atom bomb was not an immediate threat, Boris Posh writes with justifiable pride, was probably the most significant single piece of military intelligence developed throughout the war. Alone, that information was enough to justify Alsace. But Alsace managed more. It prevented the Soviet Union from capturing the leading German atomic scientists and acquiring a significant volume of high-quality uranium ore. The Belgian ore confiscated at Toulouse was already being processed through the Oak Ridge calutrons for Little Boy. At Los Alamos in late 1944, Otto Frisch, always resourceful at invention, proposed a daring program of experiments. Enriched uranium had begun arriving on the hill from Oak Ridge. By compounding the metal with hydrogen-rich material to make uranium hydride, it had become possible to approach an assembly of critical mass responsive to fast as well as slow neutrons. Frisch was leader of the Critical Assemblies Group in G Division. Making a critical assembly involved stacking several dozen 1.5-inch bars of hydride, one at a time, and measuring the increased neutron activity as the cubical stack approached critical mass. Usually the small bars were stacked within a box-like framework of larger machined bricks of beryllium tamper to reflect back neutrons and reduce the amount of uranium required. Dozens of these critical assembly experiments had gone forward during 1944. By successively lowering the hydrogen content of the material as more U-235 became available, the Los Alamos Technical History points out, experience was gained with faster and faster reactions. But it was impossible to assemble a complete critical mass by stacking bars. Such an assembly would run away, kill its sponsors with radiation, and melt down. Frisch nearly caused a runaway reaction one day by leaning too close to a naked assembly. He called it a Lady Godiva that was just subcritical, allowing the hydrogen in his body to reflect back neutrons. At that moment, he remembers, out of the corner of my eye, I saw that the little red monitoring lamps had stopped flickering. They appeared to be glowing continuously. The flicker had speeded up so much that it could no longer be perceived. Instantly, Frisch swept his hand across the top of the assembly and knocked away some of the hydride bars. The lamps slowed down again to a visible flicker. In 2 seconds, he had received, by the generous standards of the wartime era, a full day's permissible dose of radiation. Despite that frightening experience, Frisch wanted to work with full critical masses to determine by experiment what Los Alamos had so far been able to determine only theoretically, how much uranium Little Boy would need. Hence, his daring proposal. The idea was that the compound of uranium-235, which by then had arrived on the site, enough to make an explosive device, should indeed be assembled to make one, but leaving a big hole so that the central portion was missing. That would allow enough neutrons to escape so that no chain reaction could develop. But the missing portion was to be made, ready to be dropped through the hole, so that for a split second, there was the condition for an atomic explosion, although only barely so. Brilliant young Richard Feynman laughed when he heard Frisch's plan and named it. He said it would be like tickling the tail of a sleeping dragon. The dragon experiment. It became. At a remote laboratory site in Omega Canyon that Fermi also used, Frisch's group built a 10-foot iron frame, the guillotine, that supported upright aluminum guides. The experimenters surrounded the guides at table level with blocks of uranium hydride. To the top of the guillotine, they raised a hydride core slug about 2 by 6 inches in size. It would fall under the influence of gravity, accelerating at 32 feet per second per second. When it passed between the blocks, it would momentarily form a critical mass. Mixed with hydride, the U-235 would react much more slowly than pure metal would react later in Little Boy. But the dragon would stir, and its dangerous stirring would give Frisch a measure of the fit between theory and experiment. It was as near as we could possibly go towards starting an atomic explosion without actually being blown up, and the results were most satisfactory. Everything happened exactly as it should. When the core was dropped through the hole, we got a large burst of neutrons and a temperature rise of several degrees in that very short split second during which the chain reaction proceeded as a sort of stifled explosion. We worked under great pressure because the material had to be returned by a certain date to be made into metal. During those hectic weeks, I worked about 17 hours a day and slept from dawn till mid-morning. The official Los Alamos history measures the significance of Frisch's dragon tickling. These experiments gave direct evidence of an explosive chain reaction. They gave an energy production of up to 20 million watts, with a temperature rise in the hydride up to 2 degrees Celsius per millisecond. The strongest burst obtained produced 10 to the 15th neutrons. The dragon is of historical importance. It was the first controlled nuclear reaction which was supercritical with prompt neutrons alone. By April 1945, Oak Ridge had produced enough U-235 to allow a near-critical assembly of pure metal without hydride dilution. The little bars arrived at the Omega site packed in small, heavy boxes everyone took pains to set well apart. Unpacked and unwrapped, the metal shone silver in Frisch's workbench light. Gradually it oxidized to blue and then to rich plum. Frisch had walked in the snow at Kungauf, puzzling out the meaning of Otto Hahn's letters to his aunt. In the basement at Bohr's Institute in Copenhagen, he had borrowed a name from biology for the process that made these small, exotic bars deadly beyond measure. At Birmingham with Rudolf Peierls, he had toyed with a formula and had first seen clearly that no more plum-colored metal than now lay scattered on his workbench would make a bomb that would change the world. At Los Alamos in southwestern spring, denouement. He would assemble as near a critical mass of U-235 as anyone might ever assemble by hand and not be destroyed. April 12th, Thursday, was the day Frisch completed his critical assembly experiments with metallic U-235. The previous day, Robert Oppenheimer had written Groves the cheering news that Kistiakowsky had managed to produce implosive compressions so smoothly symmetrical that their numbers agreed with theoretical prediction. April 12th in America was Friday, April 13th in Japan. And on the night of that unlucky day, B-29s bombing Tokyo bombed the Riken. The wooden building housing Yoshio Nishina's unsuccessful gaseous thermal diffusion experiment did not immediately burn. The firemen and staff managed to extinguish the fires that threatened it. But after the other fires were out, the building suddenly burst into flame. It burned to the ground and took the Japanese atomic bomb project with it. In Europe, John Lansdale was preparing to rush to Stassfurt to confiscate what remained of the Belgian uranium ore. When Groves heard of the success of that adventure later in April, he wrote a memorandum to George Marshall that closed the German book. In 1940, the German army in Belgium confiscated and removed to Germany about 1,200 tons of uranium ore. So long as this material remained hidden under the control of the enemy, we could not be sure but that he might be preparing to use atomic weapons. Yesterday I was notified by cable that personnel of my office had located this material near Stassfurt, Germany, and that it was now being removed to a safe place outside of Germany, where it will be under the complete control of American and British authorities. The capture of this material, which was the bulk of uranium supplies available in Europe, would seem to remove definitely any possibility of the Germans making use of an atomic bomb in this war. The day these events cluster around, April 12th, saw another book closed. At midday, in Warm Springs, Georgia, while sitting for a portrait, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in the 63rd year of his life, was shattered by a massive cerebral hemorrhage. He lingered comatose through the afternoon and died at 3:35 p.m. He had served his nation as president for 13 years. When the news of Roosevelt's death reached Los Alamos, Oppenheimer came out from his office onto the steps of the administration building and spoke to the men and women who had spontaneously gathered there. They grieved as Americans everywhere grieved for the loss of a national leader. Some also worried about whether the Manhattan Project would continue. Oppenheimer scheduled a Sunday morning memorial service that everyone in and out of the tech area might attend. Sunday morning found the Mesa deep in snow, Philip Morrison recalls of that day, April 15th. A night's fall had covered the rude textures of the town, silenced its business, and unified the view in a soft whiteness, over which the bright sun shone, casting deep blue shadows behind every wall. It was no costume for mourning, but it seemed recognition of something we needed, a gesture of consolation. Everybody came to the theater, where Oppie spoke very quietly for 2 or 3 minutes, out of his heart and ours. It was Robert Oppenheimer at his best. When, 3 days ago, the world had word of the death of President Roosevelt, many wept who were unaccustomed to tears, many men and women, little enough accustomed to prayer, prayed to God. Many of us looked with deep trouble to the future. Many of us felt less certain that our works would be to a good end. All of us were reminded of how precious a thing human greatness is. We have been living through years of great evil and of great terror. Roosevelt has been our president, our commander-in-chief, and, in an old and unperverted sense, our leader. All over the world, men have looked to him for guidance and have seen symbolized in him their hope that the evils of this time would not be repeated, that the terrible sacrifices which have been made and those that are still to be made would lead to a world more fit for human habitation. In the Hindu scripture, in the Bhagavad Gita, it says, "Man is a creature whose substance is faith. What his faith is, he is." The faith of Roosevelt is one that is shared by millions of men and women in every country of the world. For this reason, it is possible to maintain the hope. For this reason, it is right that we should dedicate ourselves to the hope that his good works will not have ended with his death. Vice President Harry S. Truman of Independence, Missouri, who knew only the bare fact of the Manhattan Project's existence, said later that when he heard from Eleanor Roosevelt that he must assume the presidency in Franklin Roosevelt's place, "I kept thinking, the lightning has struck. The lightning has struck." Between the Thursday of Roosevelt's death and the Sunday of the memorial service on the Hill, Otto Frisch delivered to Robert Oppenheimer his report on the first experimental determination of the critical mass of pure U-235. Little boy needed more than one critical mass, but the fulfillment of that requirement was now only a matter of time. The lightning had struck at Los Alamos as well. Part 3. Life and Death. What will people of the future think of us? Will they say, as Roger Williams said of some of the Massachusetts Indians, that we were wolves with the minds of men? Will they think that we resigned our humanity? They will have the right. C.P. Snow. I see that as human beings, we have two great ecstatic impulses in us. One is to participate in life, which ends in the giving of life. The other is to avoid death, which ends, tragically, in the giving of death. Life and death are in our gift. We can activate life and activate death. Gil Elliott. 18. Trinity. Within 24 hours of Franklin Roosevelt's death, two men told Harry Truman about the atomic bomb. The first was Henry Louis Stimson, the upright, white-haired, distinguished Secretary of War. He spoke to the newly sworn president following the brief cabinet meeting Truman called after taking the oath of office on the evening of the day Roosevelt died. Stimson told me, Truman reports in his memoirs, that he wanted me to know about an immense project that was underway, a project looking to the development of a new explosive of almost unbelievable destructive power. That was all he felt free to say at the time, and his statement left me puzzled. It was the first bit of information that had come to me about the atomic bomb, but he gave me no details. Truman had known of the Manhattan Project's existence since his wartime Senate work as chairman of the Committee to Investigate the National Defense Program, when he had attempted to explore the expensive secret project's purpose and had been rebuffed by the Secretary of War himself. That a senator of watchdog responsibility and bulldog tenacity would call off an investigation into unaccounted millions of dollars in defense plant construction on Stimson's word alone gives some measure of the quality of the Secretary's reputation. Stimson was 77 years old when Truman assumed the presidency. He could remember stories his great-grandmother told him of her childhood talks with George Washington. He had attended Phillips Andover when the tuition at that distinguished New England preparatory school was $60 a year and students cut their own firewood. He had graduated from Yale College and Harvard Law School, had served as Secretary of War under William Howard Taft, as Governor General of the Philippines under Calvin Coolidge, as Secretary of State under Herbert Hoover. Roosevelt had called him back to active service in 1940, and with able assistance, especially from George Marshall, and despite insomnia and migraines that frequently laid him low, he had built and administered the most powerful military organization in the history of the world. He was a man of duty and of rectitude. "The chief lesson I have learned in a long life," he wrote at the end of his career, "is that the only way you can make a man trustworthy is to trust him, and the surest way to make him untrustworthy is to distrust him and show your distrust." Stimson sought to apply the lesson impartially to men and to nations. In the spring of 1945, he was greatly worried about the use and consequences of the atomic bomb. The other man who spoke to Truman on the following day, April 13th, was James Francis Burns, known as Jimmy, 66 years old, a private citizen of South Carolina since the beginning of April, but before then, for 3 years, what Franklin Roosevelt had styled assistant president. Director of Economic Stabilization, and then Director of War Mobilization, with offices in the White House. While FDR ran the war and foreign affairs, that is, Burns had run the country. "Jimmy Burns came to see me," writes Truman of his second briefing on the atomic bomb, "and even he told me few details, though with great solemnity he said that we were perfecting an explosive great enough to destroy the whole world." Then or soon afterward, before Truman met with Stimson again, Burns added a significant twist to his tale. That in his belief, the bomb might well put us into a position to dictate our own terms at the end of the war. At that first Friday meeting, Truman asked Burns to transcribe his shorthand notes on the Yalta Conference, 3 months past, which Burns had attended as one of Roosevelt's advisors, and about which Truman, merely the vice president then, knew little. Yalta represented nearly all Burns' direct experience of foreign affairs. It was more than Truman had. Under the circumstances, the new president found it sufficient and informed his colleague that he meant to make him Secretary of State. Burns did not object. He insisted that he be given a free hand, however, as Roosevelt had given him in domestic affairs. And Truman agreed. A small, wiry, neatly made man, a team of contemporary observers describes Jimmy Burns, with an odd, sharply angular face from which his sharp eyes peer out with an expression of quizzical geniality. Dean Acheson, then an assistant secretary of state, thought Burns overconfident and insensitive. A vigorous extrovert, accustomed to the lusty exchange of South Carolina politics. Truman essayed the South Carolinian most shrewdly a few months after their April discussion in a private diary he intermittently kept. Had a long talk with my able and conniving Secretary of State. My, but he has a keen mind. And he is an honest man. But all country politicians are alike. They are sure all other politicians are circuitous in their dealings. When they are told the straight truth, unvarnished, it is never believed. An asset, sometimes. A politician's politician, Burns had managed in his 32 years of public life to serve with distinction in all three branches of the federal government. He was self-made from the ground up. His father died before he was born. His mother learned dressmaking to survive. Young Jimmy found work at 14, his last year of formal education, in a law office. But in lieu of classroom study, one of the law partners kindly guided him through a comprehensive reading list. His mother, in the meantime, taught him shorthand, and in 1900, at 21, he earned appointment as a court reporter. He read for the law under the judge whose circuit he reported and passed the bar in 1904. He ran first in 1908 for solicitor, the South Carolina equivalent of district attorney, and made himself known prosecuting murderers. More than 46 stump debates won him election to Congress in 1910. In 1930, after 14 years in the House and 5 years out of office, he was elected to the Senate. By then, he was already actively promoting Franklin Roosevelt's approaching presidential bid. Burns served as one of the candidate's speechwriters during the 1932 campaign and afterward worked hard as Roosevelt's man in the Senate to push through the New Deal. His reward, in 1941, was a seat on the United States Supreme Court, which he resigned in 1942 to move to the White House to take over operating the complicated wartime emergency program of wage and price controls, the assistant presidency of which Roosevelt spoke. In 1944, everyone understood that Roosevelt's fourth term would be his last. The man he selected for vice president would therefore almost certainly take the Democratic Party presidential nomination in 1948. Burns expected to be that man, and Roosevelt encouraged him. But the assistant president was a conservative Democrat from the Deep South, and at the last minute, Roosevelt compromised instead on the man from Missouri, Harry S. Truman. "I freely admit that I was disappointed," Burns writes, with understatement approaching lockjaw, "and felt hurt by President Roosevelt's action. He made a point of visiting the European front with George Marshall in September 1944, in the midst of the presidential campaign. When he returned, FDR had to appeal to him formally by letter, a document Burns could show around, to endorse the ticket with a speech." Burns undoubtedly regarded Truman